Tonight, the reason why we're all here, y'all know him, y'all love him. hopefully. Leonard F. from Santa Maria.
My name's Leonard. I'm an alcoholic. Hey. I'm grateful to be sober, and I'm grateful to be in this meeting. Jim, you left your candy. Whatever you did. Hey, Rob. Wow, a lot of birthdays. I was pretty cocky before when I got here, and I saw all this time. I got real nervous, you know? It's like, wow. I don't know why they leave this gavel up here. It's like just to mess with us, huh? Yay, I'm in charge. So with this drunk lady, right? She comes stumbling home, and she walks in the bedroom, and her husband's laying in the bed. And she points at him. She goes, "See, that's the pig I've been sleeping with." And she has a duck in her arm. And her husband says, "It's not a pig, that's a duck." She says, "I was talking to the duck." I like that. We got like a half an hour. If I go over, I hope you guys are okay with that. If not, you can just leave. I'll be all right. So what it was like and what happened. So I'll just tell a little bit about my family, give you some background of, you know, where I come from and who I am. Okay. I grew up as a military brat. So my father, we traveled everywhere. Every 4 years we moved. I was actually born in Roswell, New Mexico, and so we bounced around, and life was pretty good. You know, we had a pretty good standard of living, a pretty good quality of life. One of the things about the Air Force is that, you know, they have a saying, everybody is blue. You know, so my perception of the world was different than probably what a lot of kids my age was, or is, and so. I don't know, but I always remember that I have alcoholism, but, you know, my first crimes were lying and stealing and cheating. I don't know what it was. I was just one of those kind of kids. You know, I would always hear as a kid, "You're just a badass little boy," you know, and I lived up to that. You know, I have three sisters, and, you know, and it was my mother and my three sisters and me and my dad. My dad was a rageaholic. You know, he was he could make the paint on a wall peel when he screamed. And I was terrified of him. But I was his kid, you know. So, you know, my dad's name is Leonard. And so my dad was Big Leonard and I was Little Leonard. And my sisters and I imagine my mother, they hated him. They just hated him, you know. And so that played a big part in my family unit because I always kind of felt like I was the odd man out. You know, as much as I love my dad, he was an asshole, so I didn't really want to be around him, you know. But then my sisters had their little clique over there, and they were always jealous of me. I mean, he was such an ass that I remember one Christmas, one whole side of the Christmas tree was toys for me, and the other side was for my sisters, you know. So it was that kind of resentment at the time I didn't pay a lot of attention to, but later in my life I would start to see how that manifested. So that's kind of where I came from. My mom was a little on the crazy side, you know, rightfully so. And she was an alcoholic, you know, but she was functioning. You know, she was a military wife. We were dependents, you know, and one of the things about being dependents is that I was kind of raised to believe or with this idea that that I was here to serve my dad. It's like everything was about him. Everything was his. Everything was about him. And that had a big impact on me as well. So, you know, I remember I took my first drink. Well, I had drank before because I would get, you know, they'd put beer in my bottle and stuff like that. But I was about 8 years old. No, I think I was more like 10 or 11. And they would have cocktail parties back then. I don't know if you guys, anybody's that old. But then you had cocktail parties and they would buy like half a gallon of jugs. And they'd be in these little things you could tip. You know, you'd have to pick it up and pour it, you know, and lots of ice. And people would leave their little watered-down drinks sitting there. So I went around taking sips of watered-down drinks. And I remember walking through the party thinking I was so cool because everyone's standing up, and I'm this little kid. You know, I'm thinking, nobody knows what I'm doing, you know. And when I came to, I was laying in my bed, and I was covered in vomit. And my family was standing around me laughing. You know, of course, their thing was, "Oh, that'll teach you a lesson." It's like, yeah, that taught me a lesson. You know, but from right after, from the very beginning, I drank for the effect. You know, my skin just didn't fit. You know, things just didn't feel right. Life just didn't feel right. And I remember walking around thinking that everyone in the world knew something. You guys had a secret and you weren't telling me. Because everyone else looked like they were happy, joyous, and free, and I just wasn't getting it. And this was at a pretty early age. So ultimately what happened is that we lived in Germany and my parents divorced. Now, I had a pretty good childhood up to that point. Matter of fact, I had a magical childhood up to that point. You know, I traveled all over the world, you know, learned different languages, saw different cultures. But when my parents split up, my father came out here to California. My mother moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And so up to that point in my life, I kind of had an understanding of the racial issues. You know, I remember when I was growing up, it was in the 60s, you know, and, you know, I would watch, you know, the civil rights thing on TV and stuff like that. And, you know, I always fantasized myself as being, you know, a little Black Panther. But I didn't really understand it. I didn't see it. It wasn't there for me to see in the military. So when I moved to Atlanta, I got to see it, you know, and I went from this world of blue to this world of all Black. And my father was a chief master sergeant. So, you know, that's like one of the top NCOs that you could have. So my dad was the boss. I mean, people would literally, like, for lack of a better word, they would kiss my ass because I was that who my dad was. You know, so I had like this notoriety that was that went along with it. I also had a sense of entitlement. And I picked that up as well at that time. And so my mother moved to Atlanta. And so it was me, my three sisters, and my mom, and we were poor. You know, my father was an asshole. He wouldn't pay. He just didn't want. I don't know what the situation was, but money was always an issue with him, always. So we were poor, and you know, young man at 13 years old with three women in the house. That, you know, was just there was that implied thing that, you know, you had to take care of your mother and your parents. Now, one of the things about moving around and being that young is you become very adaptable, and I acclimate very quickly. I'm one of those people that, as a lot of you know, I have the gift of gab. I can chalk a cat out of a tree, and then make it go back up the tree. You know what I mean? So I adapted very quickly, and in this environment, you know, what I adapted to was that criminal element. You know, that's what was there, and that's what I kind of just moved towards. So my thing was, I became, you know, and I was a teenager. You know, I was a teenager. So I really, got involved in things like, you know, con artists, being a con artist. They call them grifters, things like that. Three-card Molly, running games on people. You know, the occasional, you know, breaking in people's houses, things like that. But the whole mentality was that if I wanted something, I had to take it from someone else. You know, the concept of work or job or any of those things was just non-existent. The other thing that I did was that because, you know, I grew up in a house full of women, I adore women. I love women. But that became a way for me to survive. And so I very quickly began to learn how to exploit women in order to get through life and to do the things that I did. So I engaged in a lot of that type of stuff. And that's pretty much what I kind of moved towards as my way of seeing of how am I going to survive? I mean, we all decide we have to develop these survival skills. And so those became my survival skills. I became a salesman. Later on, I turned out into becoming into sales. And a lot of this stuff I didn't know. I didn't know this stuff. You know, that's one of the things about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, this has been a program of self-discovery. You know, I always thought I knew who I was, but I hadn't taken the time to really sit down and look at it. And looking at the patterns and the conditions that had happened that were a result of just the environment that I grew up in. So in that, I very quickly got in a lot of trouble. And so my father would graciously fly us out here during Christmas. Just me and my little sisters, the other ones stayed. They wouldn't have anything to do with them. He would fly us out here for Christmas and take us to Disneyland and then fly us back. And then one year we flew out here and we got in the car to go to the airport and he said, you're not going back. You're staying here. And my mother told him he can't come back here. They're going to kill him. So I ended up in Lompoc, California. Now, the irony of it was is that, you know, even at that age, my addiction, well, I guess it had. I couldn't see it, though. You know, my addiction, guys, got to keep, my alcoholism hadn't really taken off as much. But, and I'm going to talk about other substances. Like the second day of school, I found myself in the carport across the street from the high school slamming heroin. Don't ask me how that happened, but that's how it happened. And from there, it just took off. You know, it just took off from there. You know, I very quickly got involved in, you know, the drug life. I don't know, a lot of you may not relate, but, you know, I come from a place where there's a subculture. We have a subculture, you know, and it's, you know, we talk about thugs and criminals and things like that. And so, and I embrace that, and I embrace that culture. And I got involved in gangs and things like that. And I grew up at a very critical time in the history of this country. So, you know, I got through high school. I don't know how I did that. Well, actually, I didn't get through high school. I got kicked out of high school, I got my high school sweetheart pregnant, and had a shotgun wedding. I still remember that. And I had gotten in trouble, and basically what had happened is I got her pregnant, then I got in trouble, and then I went in front of the judge, and he said, you know, either you join the Army or we're going to send you to youth authority. So that was an easy fix. And then my dad said, you're not going anywhere until you marry this woman. So I married her. We had a baby, and I took off to the wonderful world of the United States Army. Now, I don't know if any of you have been in the military, but they drink in the military. And they drink a lot. And you take a 17-year-old young man who's an alcoholic, and you give him some money, and you put him, you know, and you give him that freedom. And everything turned into a blur. It was just one big blur. It took her about a year to decide that I can't do this. And so she came back here to California with my son Leonard, and I just went full blown. And I also became, because of the gangs and things like that, a lot of the violence started. And so I got involved with some gang things there, and I ended up getting kicked out of the military for hurting the guy really bad. And so I came back to California hoping that I could recoup that relationship that was destroyed, still damaged, still destroyed to this day. And it didn't happen, so I was pissed. I was really angry. And so I very quickly just took to the streets and decided that I was gonna sell drugs and exploit women. And that's, you know, and that was it. And I was gonna do it with everything I had, which was a good plan. It didn't work very well because, you know, the alcohol and the drugs took over, you know. And then another thing happened, and I don't know what year it was. It must have been like 1990. It was called cocaine. I don't even know how to describe what happened in those few years, but all of a sudden one day it was like somebody flew over Lompoc and opened up an airplane and just dropped massive amounts of cocaine into our communities. And it was at the time, it was really exciting. I'll be honest with you, it was really, really exciting. Because I was someone who had been an intravenous drug user, I had an advantage. And what that advantage was that I used drugs intravenously, so I didn't, you know, I snorted, I didn't smoke or anything. So when crack cocaine came out, me and my friends, we took advantage of that. You know, and we had a thing. It's like, you don't ever smoke any crack, but you can sell as much as you possibly can. And that's what we did. One of the burdens that I carry is that, you know, I go back and I go to Lompoc to this day, and I still know people, and I still see people who smoke crack that I gave them their first hit of crack cocaine. I mean, we literally went around door to door with a pipe and a rock and giving it to people and saying, hit this. And literally destroying their lives, watching them turn into just a completely different being, which a lot of them never came back. None of them will ever be the same, and neither will their kids or their children, because of that. We destroyed, I played a part in literally destroying our community in Lompoc, California. And the residue still exists to this day. I remember later on I became a drug and alcohol counselor, and I remember talking to some clients, and I remember them saying to me, you know what, I never slept in a bed, and I never ate dinner at a table because my parent was a crackhead. And that's a horrible thing. It's a horrible thing because kids don't have any choice. What we do to our kids when we're doing this drugs is, you know, I talk about my childhood and the impact that it had on me. And I had a dad, and we ate dinner every day, and I've always slept in the bed. And so I think a lot about that kind of stuff. So that's what happened. And then I played out a script. You know, we have a script that we have, and the script was, you know, you sell drugs until you get caught, and then you get caught and you go do your time and you go get healthy and you come back out and then you sell more drugs. And you just do that, and you just do that over and over and over again. Fortunately for me, though, that I know by the grace of God, I had a pretty decent childhood, so I knew that there was a better way to live. So I was always a little bit, I don't want to say better, but maybe smarter or more aware than most of the people that I grew up with. Most of them are either dead or in prison for the rest of their life. I always knew that there was something else. And so I always had a plan. You know, it's like I always had a plan. And part of that plan was that, so when my dad got a hold of me, so we'll back up. So when my dad got a hold of me, and I'm going to hurry up too because I want to get sober. When my dad got a hold of me and I came to California, he sent me to a psychiatrist. And this psychiatrist sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had come in here and I had sat in here with you guys. And so I knew that there was a solution. So when the insanity started getting really bad, I knew that there was a place where I could go to try to stay out of that. So what happened was I found Narcotics Anonymous. Well, it kind of found me, but I found the other fellowship. And it was pretty new back then, but I knew that this was a place that I could go that would help me to stop destroying myself. I mean, literally, it was, you know, I remember one time I was doing so many substances that I actually wrote a suicide note saying, I can't stop. I don't know what's going to happen to me. And I don't want to forget that, you know. And that's a horrible place to be in. So I found this fellowship really early on, and I would go to meetings. Things would get bad or I'd get in trouble, and I would go to meetings, and I would be able to stay sober for a period of time until I got healthy and the heat got off of my back, and then I would run back out there and do it again. Now, one of the reasons why I like to share that is because, you know, there's new people in here and people that haven't been here very long. And one of the things about those steps is that we tell you work those steps. And one of the problems with it is that the program works without the steps for a while. You know, and it's very easy, or it was very easy for me to come in here and talk like a duck, walk like a duck, and quack like a duck, and I wouldn't pick up, but I didn't have any recovery. And so what happened is that this program became another way for me to manage my drinking. You know, I'm grateful for it because God knows where I would have ended without it, but you know, I'm also mindful of the fact that I could do that to death. You know, I didn't get back here on my own. It was by the grace of God that I was able to keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back. You know, we're talking over 30 years. I will celebrate 14 years on the 1st of January. So that tells you how many years I came in and out of this fellowship. As a matter of fact, I had to come here to get sober because I had burnt the fellowship out in Lompoc. You know, I just had burnt it out. I had run through it and done so much that I had burnt it out. And that's the reality of it. That's the reality of this disease. I have a disease that tells me that, I mean, there's no way for my disease to tell me that I need help. It's just not going to do it, you know. And that's a scary thing, you know. And it's not just the drugs and alcohol. It's in other areas of my life. You know, it's impossible for this thing, whatever it is that I have inside of here, for it to tell me, Leonard, you know what, that's enough. Maybe you should do something different. It just doesn't work. So in all of that, so I'm gonna get sober now. All right. Again, for like the 1,000th time. So years ago, they sent me to prison. They sent me to prison on a 90-day op. Remember something, I'm a good talker, right? So I would go on the streets. I remember one time my PO came, I ran and sat down. He goes, "You're not Leonard Flip." And I said, "Yeah, I'm Leonard Flip." He says, "No, you're not." I said, "Yes, I am." And he takes out these two files and he slams them on the desk. And he goes, "No, that's Leonard Flippin. That ain't the same person I'm talking to right now." Nice. See, I'm good like that. You know what I mean? So they sent me to prison on a 90-day op. And so when I went to that prison on that 90-day op, I was like shocked. I was like, "Oh no, this is not what I want to do," you know? And I kid you not, when I got off that bus, I looked over there and there was a bunch of, you know, Mexicans and stuff like that. And I looked over there and there was a bunch of blacks and they all had their pants. You know, you guys know how your kids sag now? You know what I'm talking about? With their pants and their butts hanging out? Well, that's when it started then. I see all these guys over here saying, I'm like, "Oh no, I don't want to do that." And I kid you not, a guy walked by with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. A black guy walked by. And I went, "That's where I'm going." And so at that time, at Tehachapi, they had just started letting the lifers come down to lower yards, and they had a group. It was called the Roadsiders, and it was an Alcoholics Anonymous group at that prison. I swear to you, that saved my life. So for those on that 90-day op, I went to meetings every day, and I wrote a novel. I called it a four-step, but it was a novel. And so when I got out, they sent me to a halfway house. Yeah, they sent me to a halfway house. And I'm in this halfway house. And now you remember something. I'm still got that thug mentality, all of that, you know. Still full of game, still full of just spitting fire. But I'm going to do this program. And there was this man that would come to meetings and pick us up in this van every day. Just about every day. And I thought, who in the hell does that? You know, and just one of the most humble guys that I had ever seen or met in my life, or even to this day. And I was sitting on this fourth step, because I had read the steps. I understood them. I, you know, studied the book. And it was Billy. So I asked Billy, I said, "Billy, will you do a fourth step? Will you be my sponsor and do this fourth and fifth step?" He's like, "Sure." And so I remember we went out to the beach, and he told me the story about the Phoenix, and, you know. So, you know, it was cool. It was really cool, you know. And I think I stayed sober for about 2 weeks after I got out of that halfway house. And I went back out there and I did what I did. And I did that for quite a few years, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. One thing I will tell you about Alcoholics Anonymous is it will give you a life. You know, I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous twice. Twice. And had more kids, but I hadn't surrendered. I hadn't gotten to that place. I hadn't gotten to that sweet spot where I had completely surrendered. I still had great ideas. And the problem is, for me, isn't having great ideas, it's the fact that I act on them. You know, because I know I'm in a room full of alcoholics, and I know you got great ideas, and I know every one of them are better than my idea. But the reality of it is I've learned that I just don't act on them because they don't work. They don't, you know. But at that time, I thought they still worked. What happened was, is I did that for quite a few years, and then I had another relapse, and got locked up, as usual, and then the last time, I had really got it together. You know, self-will works really well. I mean, I had done really well. I started a business. You know, we had bought another house in Arizona, and I moved my dad out there, and I, you know, had all this money, and I had all these people working for me, and I relapsed. And what happened was, I ended up going back to prison on a technicality. And the irony of it was, is that I went back to prison on a technicality with a year sober. So talk about being pissed off. I mean, I was angry. And while I was in there, I wrote another fourth step. And when I got out, I paroled to a halfway house over here. It used to be Cook and Depot. And I was in there, and I remember I walked in here one more time, and I sat in that chair over there. Maybe it was the Alano Club. Yeah. And I walked in the Alano Club, getting off that bus, and I walked in, I sat down, and there was in the middle of a noon meeting, and I stood up and I said, "My name's Leonard, I'm an alcoholic." Disrupted the meeting, they didn't call on me. And I said, I was devastated. And I said, "You motherfuckers told me you would help me. Now help me." And I kept that chair. And I stayed in that chair. And I forgot to say that when I went to prison, when I got out, I lost everything. My father passed away. And those two sisters that he had completely cut off for the majority of their life, they took everything. And rightfully so. And rightfully so. But I was beat. I was done. And I was willing to do whatever anyone would ask me to do. And I kid you not, almost 20 years to the day, I'm sitting in a meeting and I'm sitting on another four step and Billy walks through the door. So he took me through the steps again and he gave me a job and he babysat me and he listened to me whine and piss and complain and moan. And I got to tell you, I was angry. I was very angry for a long time. You know, and it wasn't until like 5 or 6 years that I had the epiphany that the reason, because I was mad at God. I was like, God, how can you take all this from me? How could you do this to me? You know, and I've had a lot of tragedies in my life, but this one really, really hurt because you know, I'm materialistic. And I thought, felt completely wrong. I mean, I had nothing when I got out of prison, nothing. I literally didn't even have the clothes. The clothes that I wore weren't even mine. So I was very bitter. And it took me about 5 years to realize that the reason why all those things were taken away is because I wasn't supposed to have them anyway. You know? And if I'm going to do God's, if I want knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry that out, then I need to be willing to let go of the things that God doesn't want me to have. Or I can keep chasing them like I've done my whole life. So Billy, the angel Billy is swooped in and did what Billy does. And if you watch Billy, he does that. He does that. That's what he does. He's that miracle that gets people through those most difficult times, you know, most difficult times. When you're new, and I want to, you know, welcome the newcomers. And if you're new, it's rough. It's going to be rough. And it's going to be rough until it gets better. And don't kid yourself into thinking that it's just going to get better because you want it to get better. It will get better, but it's going to take time and it's going to take effort and it's going to take support. You don't have to trust everybody in here, but you better trust somebody. You don't have to be honest with everybody, but you better be honest with somebody. And you don't have to be completely willing, but you better have enough willingness to keep coming back and apply some of these principles. You don't have to do all of them, but you got to do some of them. It's a simple program. The problem is that we don't work it. I still don't work it. My life would be perfect if I had the honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness to apply these principles in every area of my life the way that they should be done. But I don't, because I'm an alcoholic. That's why we got to keep coming back to these meetings, even after 167 years. That's a whole lot of damn time. But, you know, because I'm sick like that. I am. I really am. So that's where it started for me, you know, and I ended up in a halfway house. And for those of you that are in sober livings, quit crying. I lived in a sober living for my first 4 years of recovery. Right? And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And there's lots of days where I wish that I was back in that place. Because it's a safe space, and it's a safe space for me to work on me. I always thought that all my problems were outside of me. That if I could just get this, if I could just get that, I'd be happy. And it's all bullshit. I'm my problem. And if I can't be happy with Leonard where he's at, then I'm screwed. Because I keep looking for stuff outside of me, and every time I do that, I find nothing but misery. You know? People die, they move away, they change. Stuff breaks. Prices keep going up, you know what I'm saying? It's a never-ending torture cycle. But I gotta tell you, it didn't feel good, and I didn't like it one bit. Hindsight is 20/20. You know, it's like, shit looks real good when you look back at it, but when I think about what I went through on the inside, was it nothing nice? But I did it. So I did that for quite a while, and I made a little bit of a name for myself. Part of what happened when I went back that last time into prison was, so going back to Lompoc and those men and women that I came up with, I loved those men and women. That was my family. If you're in a gang or you're in a community like that, we fall in love with those people, and it's really hard to let them go. You know, I think a lot of my relapse was about that. I couldn't let them go. I had to go back and see the homies. I had to go check them out. I had to see what they were doing. And of course, every time I did that, I would get, you know, I would drink or use. And I would get that mentality. But that's always part of my heart. So when I went to prison this last time, you know, I saw that. I saw them. I saw those people, and I thought, I can't walk out of here and leave these people here and not remember them or try to do something, because I knew I was done. That's the other part of it, is before I went to prison, because I had a year, I knew I was done. I just, that thing that had happened, that magic that happens in here had happened for me, and I knew I was done. I guess a part of me knew that the 12th step, because when I got out, I started doing a lot of prison reform and working only with people, formerly incarcerated men and women. That was just my thing. And that took me to a lot of really good places. You know, inside and outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous isn't these rooms. Alcoholics Anonymous, for me, is a way of life. It's who I am. It's how I treat other people. It's how I see the world, especially those who are still suffering. You know, especially those who no one else wants to talk to or no one else wants anything to do with. Those are the people that really need our help the most. Plus, they're the only ones that will probably freaking hear us. You know, if you're in here and you think you got your shit together, I'm not going to say anything else. So I did that. And you know, things fell in place for me. You know, things really started to fall in place for me. You know, and life got better and it got good and it got really good. You know, but this is a program of progress. I got to keep working on Leonard. And so what happened for me was, and I mean, it's not a bad thing, you know, because life does what it does. One of the things I'm really humbled about standing here right now is today I know that I get to turn around and watch all the people who have left time, have less time than me. And I get to go, oh, wow, I remember that. Oh, wow, I remember that. Oh, wow, I remember that. Oh, I can see what they're doing wrong. Oh, this is my work right here. Right? But I was so humbled to come up here and realize that all these people are standing in front of me that are going, oh, look at Leonard. Oh, I see what Leonard's doing. I think, there goes Leonard again. So it's a very humbling place to be in, because they know me better than I know myself. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. It's like you grab the hand of the person behind you and you grab the hand of the person in front of you and you hang on. And I do mean hang on. We should have safety straps around here. You know what I mean? Because it's coming. It's going to come. But that's how it works. And so I was able to get in the herd and become a part of that and live this way of life. And some of, you know, and begin to engage. And who is Jim R.? Did he leave? And Jim R. talked about that prayer and meditation and the spiritual way of life that we get here. And I've been able to step into that. And I've been able to step into a world of rocketed into the fourth dimension. I live a spiritual, I'm a spiritual being that's having a physical experience. And I'm okay inside of here most of the time. And the only time I'm not is when I start thinking. You know, that's the only time I'm not okay is when I start thinking. And these last 3 years have been the toughest time of my life, comparatively speaking. Most of the other tough times, I was so numb that I didn't know that I was going through what I was going through. I just got through it. About 3 years ago, my son Michael, 24 years old, my heart. I love this kid, you know. I know you're supposed to love all your kids the same, but you don't. You know, and some of them are really special. I mean, like really special. And Michael was a kid that was really special. And he died of an overdose on October the 30th, 2016. And it was a spiritual experience for me, and it rocked my world and it devastated me. And I thought I was over it, but I'm not. I'm never going to get over it. Never going to get over that kid. And so his anniversary is coming up, you know, and I wanted to share Michael with you, because he's the reason why I do the work that I do today, in his memory, to try to just help one more young man, one more kid. And that was kind of, so at that point I kind of moved away from the adults and started working more with the youth. And so that's brought me to a place where I have a job, it's not even a job. I have a purpose in life that is beyond anything I can imagine. I can't even put it in words to you what it's like to do the things that I do and help people the way that I help people. But it's magical. It's really magical. And I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. All of it. None of this stuff that I have or I share with you or anyone else is any of my stuff. I got it from all of you. This is a program where people love you until you can learn to love yourself. And that sounds real corny. And it sounds real easy. But what I found is that the hardest thing that I've ever had to do in my life is to let you love me. You know, when it comes down to it, the problem is that I don't know, somewhere I made this decision about Leonard, that Leonard was, something was fundamentally wrong with Leonard, and I had to convince you that it wasn't. And I had to convince Leonard that it wasn't. And if you get too close, and I think you're getting a glimpse of it, oh, you better back up. You gotta back up. And the only way I can let you get close is if I'm inebriated enough to where I don't care. And that's kind of what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You come in here and you sit in here with all your defects of character, and we laugh with you, and you go, wow, maybe I'm not that bad. And then the part I like is you get to see people more messed up than you, and you go, shit, I ain't as bad as that motherfucker. You know what I'm saying? It's like I'm good. And that's kind of where the magic happens. I want to talk about the first three steps real quick. So one of the things that my sponsor taught me and drilled in me and has been the very foundation of my recovery is I went to a ceremony today, a 12-step Native American ceremony today, and they were talking about the steps, and they had the steps broken down into, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. You know, and those first three steps were 1, 2, and 3. And one of the things about the first three steps is that, that I know today is that they're not just something for me that I had to do. There was something for me that had to happen. I had to happen at a place where I realized that I was completely powerless. That, and what I mean by powerless is would mean that I couldn't, if a fly crawled up my nose, I couldn't get it out. And I know that sounds silly, but it's like that kind of powerlessness. And what happened for me is when I got a hold of that level of powerlessness, I realized I can't run my life. There's no way I can run my life, no matter what Leonard comes up with, how good I get or how healthy I am or how much money I have, it's not gonna work. And what that did for me is it put me in a place where I became desperate to find something to help me get through life. You know, prior to this program and these steps, I always looked to God to get me what I wanted. It never once dawned on me that if God didn't want me to be here in 2 seconds, the ambulance would be here to pick me up. It just never dawned on me that I needed God for more than getting me what I wanted. But when I hit that powerlessness and all my stuff was gone and I had no great ideas, all of a sudden I realized, wow, there's got to be something that can do this. And at first it wasn't God, it was just these rooms. Remember I came in and I told you, you motherfuckers are going to fix me? So God wasn't even there yet, but I knew that there was a power in these rooms that could help me. And it did. Wasn't as quick as I wanted, but it did. A lot more difficult than I would have cared for, but it did. And so then I got to this place where I realized that there's a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. There was something that happened to me. I don't know what that mixture is. I don't know what it is, but I hope to God that you get that. Because by the time I got to the third step and I did that prayer, and I did that thing, a weight fell off of me, and the heavens opened up. That sounds kind of corny. So a weight fell off of me, and a world opened up to this day continuously to just amaze me. I am amazed at the things that my higher power does when I turn my will and my life over to it. I have a saying. It goes like this. Hold life with a loose grip. That's scary in the beginning. But when I hold my life with a loose grip and my higher power has the other end of it, some kind of way it magically puts the stuff in front of me that it wants me to have, and it removes the things that it doesn't want me to have. And does it hurt? Hell yeah, that shit hurts. You know, it hurts to not get what I want because that's my will. I want what I want. And I still want the stuff that I want. I just don't hold on to it so tight. And the other part of that is that my life. What is my life? Well, my life is what I experience. So I had these great ideas about what my life was going to be. I got news. I got to tell you, the life that I live today does not have one iota of anything that I would have chosen to have in my life. It's not even on the same spectrum of what I would want my life to be. And right now, my life kind of sucks. But I always say that. Now that I think about it. But yeah, right now I'm not real happy with my life right now. Let me put it to you like that. But it's not my life. It's what my higher power wants me to have. And that way I can sleep at night. And I can get up and I can move forward in life. And I don't have to be in this space of, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. What am I gonna do? Because it's not mine. It's like I made that decision and the weight came off and I was actually able to live. You know? And you know, that sounds real magical, and it is. But the problem is Leonard still's got all this crap in there that's blocking me from it. You know. You know, I still get up in the morning and what was John G used to say? And brush my teeth with gunpowder. I still do it, you know. But it's a lot less and my life is a lot better. But the things that I experience are just phenomenal. I don't know how it's hard to put this thing in words. Just please keep coming back. Just stick around until you get the miracle, because it is a miracle and you will get it. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. You know, and if you're looking at the outside, you're looking in the wrong place. For me, the most important thing in my life is how I feel on the inside. And I'm so, so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for that. If there was a tsunami tomorrow and I survived, I'd get up, walk outside, and say, okay, God, that's what we're going to do now. And I would be okay. I would be okay. And I was never okay. I was never okay. I would get what I want, and 5.3 seconds later, I wanted more, I wanted something else. And today, I still want what I want, but I'm okay if I don't get it. You know, and when I do get it, I know I'm supposed to have it, so I don't have to chase it. I don't have to manage it. I don't have to control it. I don't have to. It's my way or the highway. You know, and that's how I lived. You know, that's how I lived. Did that scare you guys? I've been wanting to do that for years. Hey, I'm serious. I've been wanting to do that for years. So I'll end with this. When I first got here, he used to call me the angry black man. And I was such an ass. They would ask me to come speak at here at the Lana Club, and I would wear an NA shirt. True story. And so today when I came, I thought, see, and this is growth. I got a tie on. It's a nice tie, too. Yeah, I dressed up. I put a tie on. I came here because that's what we're supposed to do. I could never. I could never do the things that I was supposed to do. I still can't. I'm undisciplined. But some kind of way, I come in here and I open myself up to you people, and all of a sudden I find myself doing things that I didn't even imagine were possible. This program is a gift from God, if you like that word or not. But, you know, just like any other gift, I got to open it up and I got to use it. I got to open it up and I got to use it. And that's where the journey comes in. That's why we can't do this thing alone. You know, no matter how good I sound, no matter how eloquent I speak, the reality of it is that I'm going to walk out that door and I still got to do life. And I don't know about you, but life has a tendency to kick my ass without this program. You know, and whenever I think that there's a solution anywhere outside of me, except for Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm in real trouble. It's been my experience that the solution to every problem that I have in my life is in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't necessarily mean that in this fellowship itself, but in this simple design for living. God is so simple. But that, isn't that with everything once you've done it? So, I thought I had something really profound to end with. All right, I got one from you. All right, so this guy's in a bar and he throws up all over his shirt. And he goes, oh my God, this is a brand new shirt. My wife's going to kill me. And the bartender says, oh, I got a good idea. So tell you what, when you go home, put $10 in the pocket. And when your wife asks you, what happened to your shirt? So I was giving a drunk guy a ride, and he vomited all over me, and he gave me $10 to get it cleaned. He goes, that's a good-ass idea. So the guy goes home. Sure enough, he walks home. His wife goes, honey, what happened to your brand-new shirt? He says, oh, some guy threw up all over me, and he gave me $10 and told me to get it cleaned. And so she reaches in the pocket. She pulls it out. She goes, there's $20 in here. He goes, oh, I forgot to mention, he shit my pants, too. So that's a visual I'm gonna send you guys home with tonight. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's give Leonard another round of applause.